The court is reconvened. Your silence is commanded.
Good afternoon, and please be seated. We'll call our third and last case for this week, 03-1225, Kalati Enterprises, Inc. v. Kellogg Sales Company, representing Kalati Enterprises, attorney George S. Peek. Is that right? Peek. You may proceed, sir.
My name is Attorney George S. Peek of Stupar, Schuster & Cooper in Milwaukee. I represent the plaintiff appellant, Kalati Enterprises, Inc. Madam Chief Justice, Justices, may it please the Court. This matter is before this Court as a result of its acceptance of the certification of this appeal by the Wisconsin Court of Appeals for District 2. The Court of Appeals certified the following issues for this Court's determination and review. First, whether this case presents a Huron Tool-type cause of action, and if so, whether Wisconsin recognizes or should recognize such a cause of action, the action being a fraudulent inducement of contract, and whether they recognize this exception to the as an exception to the economic loss doctrine.
Now that you've started your argument, let me interrupt. Just for clarification, is it your understanding of the status of the law that this Court has recognized that there is a fraud in the inducement exception to the economic loss doctrine, but that the scope of the exception is unclear?
That is exactly Kalati's position, that a majority of this Court has endorsed some exception to the economic loss doctrine for fraudulent inducement claims. Of course, this Court, after the Douglas Hanson case, had in place such an exception. After this Court's decision in DigiCorp and subsequent to that in the Teetsworth v. Harley-Davidson case, the waters are somewhat muddied as to exactly what the Justice said is the scope to this exception.
Thank you.
The second issue before this Court today is whether a duty to disclose facts arises between a sophisticated commercial buyer and seller when the parties have an established course of dealing and those facts pertain directly to that course of dealing. The Court of Appeals sought review of this case by this Court because, as noted in its certification, there are significant issues of public policy which are best left to this body. As this Court is aware, Kalati appealed this case to the Court of Appeals upon the dismissal of its entire complaint in the trial court, and a complaint that contained seven counts of misrepresentation, fraud, and contract claims. So I appealed only the dismissal of its claim for intentional misrepresentation, and in its brief to this Court, to the Court of Appeals, stated the following issues: whether the claim for intentional misrepresentation was barred by the economic loss doctrine, and second, whether Kalati's claim was properly pled. Because the landscape of Wisconsin law, as Justice Bradley has noted, has changed with regard to the economic loss issue, while this case is pending, and because when this Court decides a question of legal duty, it's making a policy determination, Kalati agrees that these issues present significant issues of public policy, which are best left to this Court. Beginning with the economic loss doctrine issue, the genesis and policies behind the economic loss doctrine are well known to this Court, and they need not be belabored here, save to note that the doctrine is driven by three public policies.
Before you get into that, can I interrupt for a minute and see if I can get my facts straight? And I'm not so sure I've got them straight at this point. It's my understanding that the dealings here with your client went on with, is it Gerasi? Is that the way they pronounce it?
That's correct.
All right. And was it the practice that your client went to Gerasi or that Gerasi on a regular basis came to your client?
It was the latter.
The
orders were solicited from my client by Gerasi.
Was Gerasi someone who came every 3 months, or what was the situation?
Pretty close. Every 4 months. In fact, these are what we called in my client's business a quarterly promotion order. In other words, every 4 months we'd get a solicitation for the order, and based on the established course of conduct, we would either take some or not take some.
And how long was it that before your client learned about the change in marketing policy by Kellogg, how long before that was it that Gerasi took this order?
To get your question straight, I just have to ask for clarification. The order was solicited from us.
Okay.
Our position and the facts in the amended complaint alleged that prior to the solicitation of the subject order, and just to backtrack a little bit, these we view as a series of contracts rather than one large contract. Prior to the solicitation of the subject order, the change or shift in marketing strategy of the defendants had occurred. The order was then solicited, and it was only about a short time after that before my client learned from its regular customers that they were no longer purchasing this product from distributors like my client, but rather were accepting them directly from...
And your client learned that from its customers?
Directly from its customers.
And it was a short time between the time these orders were taken and the time that your client learned this?
That's correct, and it was a short time, and as noted in the complaint and the allegations contained therein.
Suppose Kellogg's produced a new product. How would your company learn about that?
The only way I could answer that is that my presumption is that when Gerasi solicited orders, he came with a number of different Kellogg products. This was the established course of dealing. The only way they would learn of any new products is if, during the solicitation of the order, Gerasi indicated to them that in addition to the Rice Krispie treats and Nutri-Grain bars that are the subject in this matter, that they now are offering a third or fourth or fifth type of stuff.
Well, Gerasi might have not told them because he wanted to sell the old stuff, knew it was coming, and then they learned from their customers that they're not going to buy, the customers aren't going to buy the old stuff because there's a new product out.
Which is an excellent point, because much of the argument of respondent has lodged against my client is that we are advocating a view that allows for no ability of a commercial party to take advantage of its own business acumen. I'd offer another explanation to the court to say that if Gerasi solicited these orders for Rice Krispie bars from my client and they solicited them at a price of, say, $100 a box, when they full well knew that the going market rate was only $50 a box. This is exactly the type of business acumen that defendant could avail himself, I think, in this type of case without running afoul of any issues with misrepresentation.
Well, and I gather your complaint says that Gerasi knew that there was going to be a change in marketing plans and was told not to tell anyone. So when he made this solicitation, he had information that would affect the purchase, but did not reveal it.
Which is precisely the reason we only appealed this one claim to the Court of Appeals. Paragraph 10 of our amended complaint, in fact, denotes that an agent of my client had spoken to an agent of Gerasi's subsequent to the problem here and was told by Gerasi. And again, this is an appeal from a motion to dismiss, so we assume that this court takes as true these allegations. Was told by an agent of Gerasi that he was in fact under a confidentiality contract not to disclose the shift in marketing strategy.
How does that tie in with the notifications that are alleged in the complaint that were sent out to other customers but not to your client?
In the original complaint, we lodged three misrepresentation claims,
mm-hmm.
The negligence misrepresentation, intentional misrepresentation, and strict responsibility misrepresentation here. The notice information contained in the allegations in the complaint more or less went to the negligent misrepresentation claims rather than the intentional.
Okay, so for purposes of this claim, you have the, as alleged in paragraph 7, the May 14th solicitation by Gerasi, and then the product was delivered June 1. June 14th, customers of your client said, hey, that's it. We're not buying from you anymore. And then it was the next day that you found out about the confidentiality agreement.
That's correct.
Correct? Okay.
To get back to the argument, I said that the economic loss doctrine is driven by three important policies, and I'd like to frame my argument around these policies. The first policy is, of course, that it's important to preserve the fundamental distinction between tort and contract law. Second, the economic loss doctrine furthers the interest of the freedom of parties in the commercial contracting context to allocate the risk by the contract itself. Third is the concept that a party that is best situated to assess the risk of economic loss, which are the commercial parties themselves, that they have the right then to assume, allocate, or insure against that risk. Now, as this Court well knows, the genesis...
Let me ask a question, Mr. Peek. You talk about the policies underlying the economic loss doctrine. When you look at the first one, that it's important to keep the distinction between tort and contract law. Is it always easy to do that if you have, say, in a breach of contract setting, someone who commits a tortious act? In other words, the facts involve tortious conduct. Yeah, you understand my question?
I do. And I think the most prosaic view of the law on this is that if you look at when the conduct arises, in our case, we're talking about conduct that occurred, the misrepresentation conduct, occurred prior to the existence of a contract at all.
Well, you're viewing the contract as each quarter or each 4 months.
That's
correct. You view it as one totality of a contract.
That's correct. But again, it broadly maintains the view that these were separate contracts rather than one contract.
But what's the difference?
Well, I would suppose that if you had a general contract that set forth in specificity that Kellogg through Geraci would solicit orders per quarter from my client, then that would maybe constitute a larger contract. This, and as is common in most of the commercial world today, is kind of a bill of sale contract. As respondents will tell you here, this was simply the contract for the purchase and sale of goods. And that's the way Pilotti views that each instance of a solicitation of order constituted a new and separate contract.
And if you have a narrow scope of the exception, then it's inducement at the time of each of the purchases rather than inducement at the very beginning.
Correct. That's Pilotti's view of this.
Is it inducement at the time
pre-contract as opposed to
fraud
in the inducement to enter a contract, right?
Which is a good point, and it hits Justice Butler's question precisely, in that our view of this is that the conduct arose here prior to the entry of the contract. And the reason, and part of what we'll see, is the distinction here between contract and tort law. It's precisely this conduct that the Wisconsin Academy of Trial Lawyers, in its amicus brief to this Court, defined as moral turpitude. It's this intentional misrepresentation that provides the need to have the tort of intentional misrepresentation be applied to this kind of circumstance and not be barred by the economic loss doctrine.
Counselor, if I understand the record correctly, Kaladi tried to send the product back to Kellogg when they found out they weren't going to be able to sell it. Is that correct?
Correct.
And Kellogg refused, said that you bought it, it's yours kind of thing.
And those are the allegations in the amended complaint, that mm-hmm. that there are certain rights under the UCC, and the UCC, to be sure, is the body of law that generally governs the rights and remedies of commercial parties in this context.
Mm-hmm.
We have tried to avail ourselves of those rights, most basically the right of rescission of the contract, and that request was not accepted.
Okay.
Again, back to the argument, I would say that the genesis, as this Court knows, of the economic loss doctrine is in products liability cases. The theory here, of course, is that protection against damages caused by defective products that injure themselves are exactly the precise reason for the provisions in the UCC for express and implied warranties, and those remedies are available through the UCC. With regard to the duty, the distinction between tort and contract law, it's been law of the state since 1999 and the first Budgetel, first Microsystems case, that the duty of honesty in negotiating a contract is not an obligation that's imposed by the contract, which has not yet arisen, but rather is a duty that exists under the common law. This is to say that the duty of honesty, where to be dishonest would be to cause injury, is a duty that is imposed whether a contract exists or not. Now, this state has long recognized a cause of action for fraudulent inducement. The seminal case here is the Huguenier v. Cotter case, and this is an 1899 case.
I'm sorry, you said 1999?
1899.
Thank you.
By contrast,
in 1899, was there any discussion in the courts of Wisconsin of the economic loss doctrine?
Unfortunately, no. And in contrast, the economic loss doctrine in Wisconsin is really only about 15 or so years old. And while the seminal economic loss doctrine case is a California case, Seeley versus White Motor Company, is a 1965 case. It's not until the Sunny Slope Grading case that Wisconsin formally recognizes the economic loss doctrine.
So you're willing to concede that the old cases on fraud and the inducement are not very helpful because of the fact that there was no recognition of the economic loss doctrine until the last 15 or 20 years.
Correct. And Galati makes its point of mentioning the 1899 case just to note the contrast between the long-established view of this court in this state that we recognize a claim for fraudulent inducement.
Well, it's going to matter if about the second part of it, because it may be that you recognize a very big fraud in the inducement exception, but that this doesn't constitute fraud in the inducement.
Based on the duty question that's also before this court? Correct.
So some of these old cases may be helpful for that purpose.
Absolutely.
Okay.
Absolutely.
What are you setting in for?
Of course, Galati says that there was a duty here and that the long recognition of these fraudulent inducement claims militates for the finding that there was a duty in this case as well.
Okay.
And that duty stems from what?
Okay, we were talking the second issue now, and that is that the duty to disclose exists in this case. Now, our argument with respect to a duty to disclose is kind of twofold here. First of all, Alderman versus O'Rourke is the seminal case that talks about duty in this context, and in that case, it is set forth that it's been that silence or the failure to disclose a fact is not an intentional misrepresentation unless there's under a duty to disclose. Now, the case this court decided in Hennig versus Ahern says that we have adopted Restatement of Torts, Second, Sections 551. Section 551 absolutely frames the argument with regard to the duty to disclose. In other words, Section 551, which establishes liability for non-disclosure, is right on the heels of Section 550, which deals with fraudulent concealment. Now, the argument under Section 551 is twofold and is, as the Alderman Court stated it, and that non-disclosure is not a misrepresentation if the party is not under a duty to speak. In this way, and respondents will note this, if there's a duty, tort is available. If there's not a duty, your remedies are in contract.
So what facts create a duty in this particular case?
Section E of 551, 2E to be specific, sets forth that a duty to disclose facts basic to the transaction may arise if the party knows that the other, because of the relationship between them, would reasonably expect disclosure of these facts. Now, our position is that based on this long-existing contact between these two parties, that Galati should reasonably have expected Kellogg to tell them of this shift in marketing, that this, in fact, was a fact basic to this transaction.
Except your client didn't deal directly with Kellogg, right?
Mm-hmm. Correct. And we view our dealings with Geraci as dealing with an agent with actual authority in this case.
Was he an agent, or was he in his own corporation at the time? Not that necessarily makes a difference. Wasn't he a paid employee of Kellogg?
As my understanding is that he was an independent contractor of Kellogg, but he was an agent acting under actual authority, and that authority was disclosed to my client at the times of all this solicitation.
Is there any issue with regard to agency on behalf of Kellogg and Gervaisi here?
Not that Flotty is aware of. Flotty is aware, and none has been lodged.
I didn't see any in the briefs.
Yeah,
and
from the trial court on up, we've not seen really any issues with regard. But again, this was a case that was dismissed at the motion to dismiss stage, so there's many factual issues probably yet to be fleshed out if this...
But the allegations of the complaint allege the agency, and for purposes of the motion to dismiss, we take the allegations as true. Is that correct?
That's correct. Now, I want to follow that on this duty to disclose argument a little more. Now, again, Claudia attaches to 551.2e of the Restatement Second of Torts, and the guiding principle here is that based on this conduct between these parties, Claudia should have reasonably expected disclosure, that when these orders were solicited from Claudia by Gervaisi, Gervaisi full well knew that we marketed in what is termed in the industry as the deflection market. In other words, we are a low-level grocery distributor, and our client markets directly to these stores. The shift, as you all know from the briefs, was to switch from this type of marketing to a marketing scheme that markets the product directly to the stores. Now, knowing that Wisconsin courts have adopted 551 of the Restatement Second of Torts, what's helpful and instructive to this court are the comments and illustrations that are go along with Section 551.
Before you get the comments, and maybe you'll be answering that with regard to E, you point to 551.2E, facts basic to the transaction. And I want you to focus on, and perhaps that's what you're going with regard to the comments, why this failure to notify that they, or failure to advise or not disclose that there had been a change in the marketing, why is that basic to the transaction?
Well, that's an excellent question, because ordinarily in a purchase of goods of this nature, you're talking about the quality, character, price, time of delivery. These are essentially what are thought of as the facts basic to this transaction. Kalani believes that the shift in marketing scheme, in this case, was a fact basic to this transaction because of the long course of conduct between these parties, and because when Gervaisi solicited these orders, he knew, and these are, again, allegations in the amended complaint, he knew that that was our source of marketing. By the same token, Gervaisi knew that under this shift in marketing that he would be selling us this quarterly promotion order, which, you know, by nature would take us 4 months to sell, would be selling this four-month order of time-sensitive product where we had no traditional markets with which to sell it. Because of that, we view this as a fact that was basic to this transaction.
So this is very facts, as I guess most cases are in this area, very fact-specific. I mean, if he had sold it to you he was unaware that all of your market would dry up, then that might change your cause of action?
If I get your question, I think that's exactly what did happen. I think when these were sold to us, Gervaisi knew full well.
I said unaware. I might not have been clear. If he were unaware of that, that would change your cause of action.
If he were unaware of that, I don't know that there would be a cause of action here. And again, taking this based on the allegations in the amended complaint, we would say that he knew this and that these were facts basic to the transaction.
Mr. Peake, would this be a different case if Gervaisi had not solicited Kaladi in this matter?
In other words, if Kellogg was acting directly?
Or if, say, Kaladi had gone to Gervaisi and said, I want to fill an order with Kellogg, go fulfill this order for me, place this order, I want such and such products so that I can resell it.
I think the fact that Gervaisi did solicit these from our client certainly exacerbate the conduct here. In other words, if we were seeking out these orders and we were taking the affirmative steps to go out and hustle up this business, then I do think that it might present a different case here, at least with respect to the duty to disclose issue. Without definitively saying that, I think that it would certainly change the landscape of this case. And in Kaladi's view, it was exactly the fact that these orders were solicited and continually solicited from Kaladi that makes this conduct in this case egregious and by its view tortious.
Mr. Peek, this change in marketing strategy for Kellogg's, that must have affected lots of wholesalers like your client throughout the country. Are there other cases like this pending?
Not that Kaladi is aware of. Upon its review, we don't know of any other cases that were brought under this. And again, this goes back to Justice Bradley's note about all the discussion with regard to the protocol that was developed for the reclamation and dealing with exactly this shift in marketing. The amended complaint and the record at the trial court was replete with customer lists and customer protocols, which provided for situations that were exactly like this. And again, as I responded to Justice Bradley, while those allegations are in there to support at that time what was a negligent misrepresentation claim, they certainly militated for there being, you know, some contact. It was always Kaladi's allegation that they were one of Kellogg's customers. They appeared on Kellogg's customer lists that we acquired during the process of discovery. And our view of this is that by right we should have been included in this. Now, that's a separate issue from the issue before this court today. But we think that there were to answer your question, I think the reason that this case is unique is that I think that there are two views of this. The first is that either we negligently slipped through the cracks of all this protocol that was developed for the reclamation of product. The only thing that militates against that conclusion is, of course, the allegation in the amended complaint with regard to Geraci's knowledge of the shift in marketing and his contract to be confidential.
And also, if you negligently slip through, why wouldn't they just take the product back?
Correct. Absolutely correct.
Doesn't make sense.
Absolutely correct.
Chief, if I may ask a question, I see your red light is on, but protocol for the reclamation of product is another way for saying what you allege in your complaint, I assume, that all of that the other entities that purchased from Kellogg's got notices, in fact, several notices, it's alleged in your complaint, of the change of the market strategy, but you got none. Is that what you're talking about, the protocol for reclamation of
products? That's exactly it. And as Justice rightly notes, this was, because most of this was time-sensitive product, my understanding of this was that this was the protocol that was developed on the fly to try and deal with this situation, knowing, as Justice Cripps noted, that this would affect a great number of customers of Kellogg, all not just in Wisconsin, but all across the country. Kaladi respectfully thanks this court for lending its ear on this issue. Thank you very much.
We'll have 5 minutes in rebuttal, counsel. Jeremy P. Levinson, representing the defendants, respondents, Kellogg Sales Company, and Geraci and Associates.
Good afternoon, Your Honors. May it please the Court. My name is Jeremy Levinson of Freeburg, Finnerty, and St. John. I represent the defendant respondent, Kellogg Sales Company. With me today is Laura Brenner and James Eichholz of the Reinhardt Law Firm. They represent the defendant respondent, Geraci and Associates. They will be relying on my remarks today. Your Honors, in this case, Kaladi seeks to use the law of tort to retroactively gain protections that are typically embodied in contractual provisions that Kaladi chose not to pay for. And I'd like to define the harm that Kaladi claims it incurred. The harm Kaladi claims it incurred does not come down to the change in distribution system. Kaladi was harmed for one simple reason, quoting the allegations of the complaint. Its market changed. The demand for the product it sought to resell shrunk. It so happens they also allege that it shrunk as a result of a change in distribution. It could have shrunk, and Kellogg could have anticipated that it was going to shrink, for any number of consumer trends that Kellogg could have known through survey data, because Kellogg had plans to roll out superior new products, for any number of reasons. What caused the injury here, according to the allegations of the amended complaint, is that Kaladi's anticipated market shrunk and the demand for its product went down, lowering the value of that product.
Don't we have to accept that as accurate for purposes of ruling on the motion to dismiss?
I'm sorry.
We may not be able to prove that, but don't we have to accept that allegation for purposes of testing the complaint?
Absolutely, Your Honor. But what I think the complaint alleges is that the causation of the injury was the change in the market. Mm-hmm. I think it is effectively irrelevant to this question what caused the changes. Markets change for all sorts of reasons.
But the counsel, okay, markets change, but here the change in the market was solely the decision of Kellogg. In other words, Kellogg went from working through a food broker, basically a distributor, to direct marketing. So they're selling the same, just so I understand, mm-hmm. they're selling the same product, only they're doing it differently. So there wasn't any new product here, as you mentioned, or it could have happened. But staying with this situation, this was a product that had been sold through their food broker, Rashi, to Kaladi. Now, the change, as I understand it, was they simply directly sold the same product to the same entities, the people that Kaladi was selling to. Isn't that right? So he was in competition with them.
I think that is correct, okay. Based on the allegations of the amended complaint, that as a result of Kellogg's publicly announced acquisition of Keebler, and the amended complaint acknowledges that months before this contract came into being, Kellogg announced its acquisition of Keebler, mm-hmm. And that one of the results of the acquisition of Keebler was this change in distribution. My only point with the other examples was a variety of everyday business occurrences could have left Kaladi exactly where it ended up.
That's right. And then if the complaint had alleged each of them, we would have to then decide, is there a duty?
That's correct, Your Honor.
So you might have a different duty for different things. Maybe they're going to bring out a low-carb cookie, and that would defeat the marketing for high-carb cookies. Well, maybe there's a duty to tell. Maybe there isn't a duty to tell. But here, the question is, did they have a duty to tell change in marketing structure so that they were in competition, in effect, with someone to whom they were selling?
Certainly, Your Honor. The reason I focused on, for a moment, on those examples was in where this area of tort law and contract law converge, I believe is the nature of the injury that ends up being important. And that is what led me to my comments about many other very typical ways in which this injury could have been caused. But taking the facts as they are alleged, in terms of us effectively, Kellogg effectively starting to compete in the same market, there are a number of very well-known contractual devices, long-established contractual devices to protect against just such eventuality. You have non-compete agreements. You have exclusivity provisions with respect to customers. You have exclusivity provisions with respect to territory. You have contractual provisions regarding the right to return unsold products. And I think it is critical that we remember the type of contract this was. This was a contract for a distributorship. This was the entire value of these products to Kaladi, based on the allegations of the amended complaint, was their value on resale. That Kaladi's expectation in that regard turns, in terms of its business decisions, on such things as, what is my market? Who can compete? What is the size of that market? In other words, in the context of a distributorship contract, those mechanisms, those long-recognized contractual mechanisms, spoke to exactly the injury Kaladi now claims it incurred. Kaladi opted not to purchase any of these contractual protections. And what
did Kaladi offer them?
I don't know, Your Honor.
There's no, I shouldn't say that. In what I reviewed, I didn't see the, is there a distributorship contract in the record?
No, there's not. And I believe Mr. Peek's comments on this score were quite accurate. These were simply individual transactions.
So what I said initially, that this case is all about the pleading that we have before us in the amended complaint. That's all we have, and we take those allegations as true.
Absolutely.
And this case rises or falls based on whether or not there is a cause of action set forth in the allegation and then the other issue with regard to the economic loss doctrine?
Certainly.
Am I correct on that? That's it.
You are, Your Honor.
It's a real easy review then. Difficult questions, but easy appeal.
I think that's fair. I think that's fair.
Could you say how large a territory Kaladi was working with? Territory. I mean, is it like Waukesha County or Milwaukee County? Or?
Sure. I have to say, I have no idea, and when the court started asking fact-specific questions, I started to get a little nervous, because once upon a time, this case resolved very efficiently and very quickly without need for all of this factual development. The way I suggest most business disputes should resolve, but that was a long time ago. But as a result, we are left with the allegations of the amended complaint, and we don't have a lot of these other facts. But I do believe that it is very well established in the law of fraud that the complaint needs to allege fraud with particularity, and in a fraud by omission case must allege those facts that establish, if true, that establish the existence of the duty.
What about the facts that are alleged that contend that, one, it was Geraci that solicited Kaladi in this particular contract that's a dispute here, and two, the fact that Geraci had a confidentiality agreement with Kellogg, so that at the time Geraci negotiated that contract, Geraci knew it, but Kaladi did not.
I don't believe, well, for the purpose of the questions presented to this court and given the posture of this case, I believe it is of no moment that Geraci solicited rather than received a request. If a solicitation in and of itself constitutes the undertaking of a tort duty, it starts to look a whole lot like a warranty. There were no, and as I think is conceded, there are no representations. There have been no representations.
But doesn't it make a difference in the, assuming, I'm going based on the allegations, the allegation here is kind of that Geraci is maybe an agent of Kellogg's. Whereas if Kaladi goes to Geraci and says, hey, I want a contract with Kellogg, you got a slightly different situation, don't you?
In my view, that does not change the flow of liability in terms of Geraci serving as a broker, whether they're the ones picking up the phone or whether Kaladi's picking up the phone. I don't think for the present questions that makes a lot of difference. But if I can return briefly to the notion of these readily available contractual remedies.
Mr. Levinson, before you return there, let me stop you for a minute in regard to the arguments that you set forth in your brief, and you're just touching on them a little bit a couple minutes ago. And that, it's my understanding, you're claiming that the complaint is insufficient here. And it's insufficient because it is not specific in regard to fraud. Can you enlighten us as to exactly what you think should have been in the complaint, if it was going to be sufficient?
Certainly. And as I think this Court noted in its Teatsworth decision, the Ullerman case Mr. Peake referenced is the issue here. And in Teatsworth, this Court noted that it was an open question whether Ullerman would be expanded beyond its very specific context. And I believe Ullerman and all of its progeny established the linchpin for establishing a duty to disclose. The duty to disclose is an extremely narrow exception to a very broad rule that there is no duty to speak. In Teatsworth, this Court noted that the Ullerman decision in this respect rested on very specific policy considerations. Ullerman dealt with a situation which a sophisticated vendor of real estate sold real estate to an unsophisticated buyer, and the real estate contained a latent or hidden or not readily discernible defect. What I submit is that case and the cases that followed Ullerman carefully restrict the effect of tort law in a transactional setting to circumstances where parties do not have the opportunity to protect themselves. The bottom line is, in Ullerman...
Ullerman, I understand. I want to go back to Justice Crooks's question, because we're really just dealing with a complaint here. In my view, when you plead fraud with specificity, you plead time, place, and manner.
I have the amended complaint. I read it several times. I just read it again, and I don't know what's missing. Can you tell me what's missing so that the complaint is insufficient in an allegation of fraud, aside from whether there's a duty, just whether it's insufficient in the allegations of fraud?
Certainly, Your Honor, I believe in a case, the cases you cited in our brief establish that in a fraud by omission case, the particularity requirement requires pleading those facts that establish a duty. And I agree with Mr. Peek that Restatement Second of Tort Section 551 correctly states, or at least in large part, the law in Wisconsin. And I think that reference to that restatement provision demonstrates what's missing in the complaint.
Okay.
And I will join Mr. Peek in looking at Section 2 sub E.
Okay.
First of all, facts basic to the transaction.
Right.
The restatement is very careful to limit facts basic to the transaction as those facts understood by both parties as the essence of the contract. Unilateral expectation doesn't do it. The assertion that I would have made a different business decision if I had known the information doesn't do it. There needs to be, essentially, I believe, facts basic to the transaction are those facts around which the minds have met creating the contract. In this case, we have a very simple contract. I believe the basic facts were Kellogg would provide product, Kaladi would provide a check. Those were the basic facts. So I believe the complaint fails to allege that Kaladi did not have any basic facts with respect to this transaction. That's number one. Number two, both Section 1 paragraph 1 of Section 551 don't talk about mere inducement of an act or a forbearance, but talk about a justifiable inducement. Likewise, Section 2E talks not about mere expectation, but reasonable expectation. And what the comment to this restatement provision says many times in different ways, and as this Court's jurisprudence demonstrates, in the context of a commercial transaction between sophisticated parties, everyone has an obligation to look out for their own interests, to expend efforts to obtain that information they would like, and to make a decision as to how much money you're willing to spend on the available contractual protections. As a result, the complaint, getting back to Justice Crook's question, must, in my view, allege, number one, something that qualifies as a basic fact, but number two, why is the inducement justifiable? Why was the expectation reasonable? The answer is without alleging that diligence on the part of the allegedly injured party would not have prevented the injury.
You don't think that the course of dealing of parties over years and years and years creates any reasonable expectation or any reasonable reliance on their past relationship? I mean, that's all in the complaint.
Certainly. Well, interestingly, the course of dealing concept is embedded directly in the Uniform Commercial Code.
Well, yes, that's true. I agree. But it's not the course of dealing in regard to what we're looking at here. But go ahead.
That's correct. And, of course, in the UCC context, the course of dealing is an interpretive tool for in the case of an ambiguous contract.
Right. And I'm just talking about factually. Certainly. These are people that have dealt with each other for a very long period of time.
Go ahead.
I'm finished.
In the course of dealing, so in a contractual setting, what should your opponent have done? What should they have done here to protect themselves?
Right.
The most obvious answer is picked up the phone, called its own customers, and said, what's your demand? How much product do you anticipate needing? Or Kaladi could have decided to contract with its customers before contracting with Kaladi.
I guess I'm looking at it, all of a sudden you've got another competitor in the market. Is that an unanticipated or anticipated event that should be taken care of under that they could have anticipated somebody else coming in and selling these items? I think that the thing that concerns me, and perhaps you can help, is that here you're dealing with your very supplier, the person that you've had a course of dealing with. There's been a course of conduct, and then there's been a change in marketing, which the broker knows about, but he had a confidentiality agreement But I'm just wondering how that is anticipated and how you could have anticipated taking care of that in a contractual setting. You could have called. I don't even know if the I assume you sold these to stores. How would the stores know until they got I assume these are simultaneous. Maybe the product hadn't been put out yet. I mean, the items put out by Kellogg. In other words, they were now direct marketing. So I'm just trying to think through how a sophisticated buyer and seller dealing through a broker would have protected themselves in a contractual setting.
Certainly. With respect to the course of dealing, I think the amended complaint is quite precise on this, and I should be as precise. There is not an allegation of a course of dealing in which Kellogg or Geraci made representations about the quality of Kaladi's market. That would be a much different case. The course of dealing is simply we had done business before on a regular basis. There is no hint in the amended complaint that Kellogg did anything with respect to those previous transactions to lead Kaladi into not acting diligently to ascertain the status of its own market.
Now, suppose Kaladi had said to the salesperson, what's new? Anything new with Kellogg that I should know? And the guy says, not that I can talk about. That's an honest, full answer.
Mum's the word.
Kellogg. Or lies and says, no.
Taking the first question.
Right.
That would have the first answer, Chief Justice, you suggested, entailed no wrongful conduct whatsoever.
That's
not
right.
A very helpful answer, but a true one. And it's, I submit that a sophisticated business entity who asks a supplier, are there any changes percolating in your company that may affect me? And the answer is, I can't tell you. Rarely.
Come see me next month when you can tell me.
Mm-hmm. But rarely. Does a sophisticated business entity get such clear notice that something is underfoot? Likewise, when Kellogg publicly announced the acquisition of Keebler, that in and of itself, it strikes me, required some investigation by Kaladi. There's not even an allegation in this complaint that Kaladi picked up the phone and called Kellogg.
Aren't you dealing with failure to mitigate damages? That's the defense to this case. That's the what should you have done, distributor? But we're not there yet. You know, maybe the distributor can maintain a cause of action, but it's going to lose, you know, everything because they weren't diligent, because they failed to mitigate the damages. But I don't think we're there at this stage in terms of viewing whether or not the cause of action, whether the complaint states a cause of action. I don't think we get into affirmative defenses of failure to mitigate.
I agree with the premise of your question and comment, Your Honor. We are in a very narrow and specific area of tort law. This is not tort law writ large. This is a duty to disclose.
Let me follow up on that, if I may, because that's the thing. This is the thing that's really bothering me about the case. Let's get to it. Duty to disclose. Mm-hmm. We've adopted 551 restatements. And so we know, it's kind of nice black letter stuff. It's not always that clear, but it's black letter at least. This is what we've adopted in this state, on the duty to disclose. And I'm reading 2E, and when I'm going to skip over a few words in 2 just to be brief, so if I cause a problem, let me know. One party to a business transaction is under a duty to disclose, and I'm going to skip down to E. Facts basic to the transaction. If he knows that the other is about to enter into it under a mistake as to them, and that the other, because of the relationship between them, the custom of the trade, or other objective circumstances, would reasonably expect a disclosure of those facts. So that's the black letter law that we've adopted. Of course, there's all sorts of nothing's that easy. I think that it can be argued that Kaladi
in response to the solicitation of sale for these $120,000, 4 months, I guess it was, of product, I think Kalati would reasonably expect a disclosure that he wasn't going to have any market to sell it to.
Well, as a factual premise, or rather as part of the factual premise, I think it's important to note that the amended complaint does not allege that the market disappeared completely. If you look at the...
Okay.
I mean, by my math, is what the amended complaint alleges about an 80% shrinkage. They were able to sell some product.
There goes all the profit. Now, they're asking for, I think it was $100,000, if I remember correctly, and then there's another $13,000 or $14,000 or something like that that they're asking for. So, but I don't recall that they said it totally shrunk. They tried to sell some after that through different channels, as I recall being alleged in the complaint. But they couldn't because it was time sensitive. That's what they also alleged in the complaint.
Well, my
question.
Time sensitive spoils.
Mm-hmm. That is would be what I would infer from the
assessment. Okay, just checking.
My general reference is, and I think this area illustrates that the theory Kalati asks this court to adopt disregards all of the limiting principles inherent to Olerman, inherent to this restatement provision, and inherent to the distinction this court has maintained between tort and contract.
And let me ask you about that, Mr. Levinson. And I understand the question.
My question that you didn't answer, I think Kalati would reasonably expect a disclosure of those facts. Am I wrong? I'm sorry for that. I just wanted that.
Go right
That's
in.
Really what my question was.
I wish I had a more nuanced way of saying this, but I respectfully do disagree. In this context, reasonability is not a gut reaction. It is not intuitive. In the context of a sophisticated commercial transaction, reasonableness, all of the case law demonstrates this, includes that Kalati first try and protect itself. And the case law, including the Croft case, says you have to allege that you tried to protect yourself and it didn't work. And that's the case before this court. It wasn't reasonable because, as the economic loss doctrine jurisprudence points out, they're in a better position to know their market than we.
I'm sorry. I must not have made myself clear. I was citing from 2E, which sets forth what the duty is. And mm-hmm. So my focus is on what is the duty of Kellogg, Jurup, Lassi. That's what my question is. And part of that says, the last part is that Kalati would reasonably expect a disclosure of the facts. And I think he would under these situations. But tell me why you think he would not reasonably expect a disclosure of the facts.
The reason such an expectation, the expectation that Kellogg, while selling product, while presumably making its own profit, selling product to Kalati, the reason it is not reasonable to expect Kellogg to deliver the product along with a warning saying the markets have changed and you'll find it harder to sell this. It's not reasonable because general contract, well-established contract law would place the duty to find out that information on Kalati and not on Kellogg. Therefore, their expectation in that regard was unreasonable, and Kellogg certainly would have no way of seeing that as a reasonable expectation as required by this subsection.
Counselor, though, doesn't that change just a little bit when Kellogg wears two hats, the hats of a supplier and the hat of a competitor? I mean, generally when you assess the market, and I agree with you 100%, you're out there, you're in commercial business, you're on your own. But when the person who is selling you something with one hand and making a profit from you because of that is the person that is shutting down your participation in the market, don't we have to look at the duty just a little bit differently in that circumstance?
Your Honor, I don't believe so, because the contractual protections available in this situation are just as available with a supplier and a distributor. And number two, that there are other
avenues, other common law avenues, for someone in Kaladi's position to protect themselves. If Kellogg was tortiously competing, there's a tort for that.
Yeah, well, that,
that's not in this
case. That's not what we're talking about.
Of course. And, of course, we know that the where applicable, the equitable doctrine of rescission may help Kaladi stem its losses.
Well, but your company refused to take the product back, so if they were going to rescind it, we could have saved ourselves a lot of court time here.
Well, they sued to rescind.
Yeah.
That claim was dismissed, and they have chosen not to appeal it. My only point is Kaladi is not left high and dry. But in this case,
Mr. Levinson, let me ask, because there's one question that I've got that kind of cuts under the whole argument here. And I understand that we have to determine whether there's a duty, and we have to determine whether or not there's fraud if there's a duty. But I went back and I reread Sunny Slope, and I looked at the case, and I understand there's been an evolution of the economic law loss doctrine since Sunny Slope. But Sunny Slope dealt with the allocation of risk for product failure and failed economic expectations related to the contract. Have we come so far in our evolution of the economic loss doctrine that in your position, the doctrine bars fraudulent dealings, recovery for fraudulent dealings? Have we come that far?
Where the transaction issue is between people of equal bargaining power, equal sophistication, let's say, and the alleged misrepresentation, affirmative or by omission, deals only with the value to the buyer of the product, that claim is barred by the economic loss doctrine, yes, Your Honor. Where it doesn't meet all those requirements and there's a freestanding tort, that tort survives. And that I believe, what is also developed has been the distinction first articulated in Huron Tool. I am someone who reads Huron Tool, and I do not find that distinction as nebulous as some of the critics do. What that distinction says, I believe, what that distinction says explicitly in that decision is that where representation deals with the quality of the product, the value of the product, it is interwoven with the contract, and your remedies lie in contract, not tort. And that is, of course, exactly what we have here. I mean, Kaladi's entire claim is that the value to it of the product it purchased from us plummeted. So I believe under the Huron Tool, a Huron Tool type exception, this would be barred by the economic loss doctrine.
But you would argue we shouldn't even adopt Huron Tool? Or are you arguing that Huron Tool is the law here?
Well, at the risk of using some of my precious moments on an uphill battle, I believe when a transaction involves sophisticated parties, that there is no need for an exception. The case law demonstrating that negligent and strict responsibility and misrepresentation does not, in light of the policies on which the doctrine rests, require an exception. Those policies are no differently affected by an intentional misrepresentation. All three forms of misrepresentation represent merely the unexpected injection of an unforeseen fact or an inaccurate bit of information into the transaction. All forms of misrepresentation impact the freedom to contract, to allocate risk, and to assess the risks associated with the market in exactly the same way. And in fact, any bit of dumb luck can do that in a contractual setting. What makes fraud different, if anything, it seems to me, is our moral discomfort with it. Courts, for very good reasons, are hesitant to hear an allegation of fraud and say, you're a sophisticated business party, you went out of your way to define a private relationship, deal with it on your own.
But isn't it more than moral discomfort? That if you're dealing with a fraudulent contract where one party commits a fraud upon the other, don't you have the parties no longer at the same bargaining level? You've got different bargaining powers here because one has information that is precluded from the other? I mean, don't you change the way the scales kind of weigh?
That is precisely the case as well with a negligent misrepresentation. However, the party may not know that it has the information. Negligent misrepresentation says they had the information or should have had the information, and they failed to use due care to transmit it to us. Same exact situation as an intentional misrepresentation. I see my time is up. May I be permitted to very briefly conclude, Your Honor?
Very, very quickly. But Justice Prosser has a question.
This pertains to a question that Justice Crooks asked. for Kellogg's, is this a unique case?
To the best of my knowledge, Your Honor. I am unaware of other cases that arose from this.
Why do you think that is?
My answer will take me beyond the four corners of the amended complaint, where I'm happy to go if you'd like. The fact is, Kellogg acquired Keebler in large part because Keebler had a revolutionary distribution system called door-to-door distribution. That reason for the acquisition of Keebler and Kellogg's intent to implement it was broadcast publicly for the months leading up to this transaction. I think it was covered by the Business Times of Hindustan, for example. It was publicly
disclosed. Business Times of what?
Business Times of Hindustan.
It was published here.
West Publishing apparently can get almost anything.
The complaint, the complaint counsel alleges.
You're saying among other
sources.
You're saying among other sources.
Amongst other sources. That was not, they didn't get a scoop on
Chief.
That's right. That's right. I believe so. In my office, I have 3/4 inch public reports that predate the contract at issue here.
Are you saying that Kellogg is the only distributor too stupid to appreciate the new world order in cereal distribution?
In this place, I probably would not choose that word. I would say Kellogg appears to be unique in terms of making a business decision not to further investigate once some of these facts were publicly made before this contract. In closing,
counsel. But that's not where we are here.
I'm sorry?
It's a good defense. It may be a good defense, counsel, but that's not where we are in this case.
Precisely, and that's why I acknowledged I was going beyond the four corners of the amended complaint. In closing, Your Honor, this court and courts like it have shaved a lot of the rough edges off of commerce over the past century. This court has acted very carefully in its fraud jurisprudence and its economic loss jurisprudence, however, not to stunt what is still recognized as the engine of commerce, which is self-interest and the knowledge that I need to protect myself because the other guy isn't going to. Kellogg's theory asks for a reward for not protecting itself. It asks for tort damages instead of contract damages because it never bothered to try and get this information. As a result, we believe the limiting principles in Overman and the restatement in the economic loss doctrine jurisprudence must be preserved in order to avoid truly disrupting the engine of commerce. We ask this court to affirm the judgment below on a finding that there was no tort duty here to disclose the information Kellogg has alleged in its complaint. If you find no duty exists, if you find a duty exists, or if you find no duty exists but nonetheless would like to reach the question to further develop the law in the area, we also ask this court to hold that no possible exception to the economic loss doctrine would permit this claim to go forward. Thank you very much for your attention.
Thank you, Mr. Levinson. Mr. Peek.
Well, Kellogg would submit, just to start out here, that as a small business in comparison to Kellogg Sales Company, that they are more acutely aware of the engines of commerce here than Kellogg may be. The second justification or policy that drives the economic loss doctrine is that the doctrine should be in place because it protects the freedom of commercial parties to allocate this risk of economic loss in a contract. Now, legally, of course, parties can't insure against intentional conduct, and we know that, and that's what led this court in Martin versus Nathan to say that freedom of contract is absolutely premised on a bargain that is freely made through a bargaining process that has integrity. Budgetel was close on the heels of that idea when it said that contract negotiations that begin with the assumption that the other party is lying hardly encourage free bargaining. And rather open up the door to sharp practice. Kellogg's claims intentional misrepresentation ask this court to not open that door to such sharp practices. In other words, how could risk be allocated freely if a party can't rely on what representations are true from their adversary and what aren't? We as Kellogg, have alleged in our brief that with respect to the duty to disclose issue, that Restatement 551 really frames the issue with regard to duty.
Mr. Peek, Mr. Levinson implied that your client had adequate contract remedies here. True or not?
I think you can look at the contract provisions. I think he was talking about covenants not to compete or exclusivity provisions in the contract. If you couple that and the other side look at this idea of allocating risk of economic loss, then the landscape here dramatically changes from a bill of sale contract and would be developed into the type of transaction where an elaborate contract would need to set forth all this. Now, Kaladi's view is to have a party like Kaladi have to contemplate every possible risk of economic loss it might suffer as a result of entering a contract is too exacting a requirement to burden commercial parties with.
Is there any allegation in your complaint, your amended complaint, that your client tried to negotiate any of these devices or remedies, if you will, the non-compete agreement or the exclusivity agreement or the return of product provisions, any allegation to that effect?
There are no allegations to that effect. And I just follow up the question to say that I say that were such things to enter the contract negotiations, we're talking about dramatically different landscape to the commercial transaction. Mr. Levinson will tell you that it costs money to have the exclusivity provisions and the non-compete provisions.
Also, Grayson, don't you get into a dealership arrangement and not just a supplier-distributor, which is what you're arguing to us? Well, then you're going to give Mr. Levinson all sorts of different problems under a different part of the statute.
But doesn't your client make a decision then that price dominates and your client won't worry about having such protections? I mean, isn't that implicit in not attempting to negotiate these things?
I don't know that it's any more implicit than by Kellogg's choice not to have provisions, which also cost money, to allocate this risk of economic loss in some way. If such provisions were in here, in other words, we make no warranty about your profitability on this product or your market, or that we've done anything, we may have done something to shorten your market, then that costs money too. And in other words, the Barks and Rice Krispies all of a sudden is worth a lot less to my client by having these provisions in the contract. It goes both ways. Neither one of us did it in this case, and that leaves us exactly where we are, which is with this issue for decision here today.
Can you explain Mr. Levinson's position to me? I want to make sure I understand. Is he saying that there were contract remedies available on these facts, or is he saying that on these facts there is no remedy because there is nothing wrong?
My understanding of Mr. Levinson's argument is this, that in this commercial arena, that there are remedies and provisions that could have been inserted in this contract, either by my client or by his client, that might address things such as the allocation of risk or exclusivity of dealing or covenants not to compete or things of that.
I'm not talking about revising the contract, but a remedy like breach of contract or rescission of contract or something like that. Is he saying any of those things are available on these facts?
My understanding is that if, and again, we appeal just the intentional misrepresentation claim. My understanding is that if there was recovery in Mr. Levinson, it would have to be lodged under some sort of contract theory.
And there's no contract theory here because these were not elements of the contract.
Correct. My time's up. I just want to follow up with one quick thought here. I think that, I don't want to beat this horse, but 551 is where we really focus in on this duty, and I think that restatement of torts second 551 frames the issue for this court about when a duty will arise. Mr. Levinson's description of the commercial world is, in Claudia's view, archaic. Now, caveat emptor used to be the rule, and everyone was out for himself. The comments to 551, particularly comment L, and it says that the continuing development of modern business ethics limits, to some extent, the privilege to take advantage of ignorance like this. And In general, the cases in which the rule stated in Clause E that we've been discussing here today has been applied to those in which the advantage taken of plaintiff's ignorance is so shocking to the ethical sense of the community and is so extreme and unfair that it amounts to a form of swindling or a trap. That's what Clause E says is going on here. And because of that, we'd like you to find that there was, in fact, a duty to disclose here, and further than that, that this type of claim is not barred by the economic loss doctrine. To rule otherwise, Clause E believes, would be to put a badge of fraud on the commercial process.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Levinson, for yet another argument on a judicial doctrine of economic loss. That concludes our hearing in 03-1225, Kaladi Enterprises versus Kellogg Sales Company. The court is in recess until its next scheduled oral argument, and the court will meet in the conference room at 3:15.